From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about wit. And what is it, wit? The journalist James Geary has been writing about this, and he says it's not just being funny. Geary says wit is a fundamental operating system of human creativity. In fact, he says wit is a state of mind that helps us make sense of the world. It's wise, it's frisky, it's honest, and he says we need it. We'll be right back.
Have you added a new smart speaker to your home? They're amazing, right? In fact, you can make your Amazon Echo, Google Home, or Apple HomePod even smarter. Ask it to play KUER. Your digital assistant will serve up our live stream filled with the latest news and brain-expanding shows like Marketplace, Radiolab, and All Things Considered. To find out more about how to use your smart speaker, go to KUER.org and click on How to Listen. Or just tell your device to play KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The journalist James Geary's latest book is an exploration of wit. What it is, how it works, and why, as he puts it, we need it. It's actually the subtitle to the book, called Wit's End. In it, Geary writes about this short story by the science fiction writer Isaac Asimov. It's about a scientist who does this experiment to find out where jokes come from. And what he discovers, according to the story, is that all the jokes on the planet, they came from an alien civilization who wrote them and then placed them in our brains as a kind of psychology experiment to test how we think. And it turns out that's a pretty good way of explaining how wit works. Because it starts in our brains, of course, and then it manifests itself in puns and jokes and gags, but also philosophy and physics, in folk stories and mythology. James Geary is joining us today to talk about wit. He's the deputy curator at Harvard's Nieman Foundation for Journalism. He's the author of a number of books on language and wordplay. He joined us from the studios of WHRB in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Let's begin with some basics. You mentioned in a very clever way in the acknowledgments at the end that you first embarked on this. It's been a long time ago. You say you first picked up a pen to write about this in 2010. So just give me a sense of what got you thinking about this, how you started thinking about this.
Yeah, it kind of was came out of the book that I wrote previous to Wit's End was about metaphor. It's called I Is Another. And in researching that book, and I've always been, since I was, you know, a very young boy, very interested in language and aphorisms and all kinds of wordplay and, you know, short, witty, philosophical sayings. And I've written a couple of books about aphorisms, and I got to wondering what makes aphorisms and that kind of compressed but highly impactful use of language, what makes it actually work?
Yeah.
And I realized that it was metaphor. That, you know, so many of the aphorisms and sayings that we use every day, you know, like a penny saved is a penny earned, or they're like two peas in a pod. I never let school interfere with my education. That last one's by Mark Twain.
Right.
The reason that they're so evocative and they can be so brief is because they use metaphor, and they let the metaphor carry the sort of the freight of the meaning and the significance. And when I came to finishing up the book on metaphor in 2010, I got to wondering what makes metaphor tick. And I realized it was wit.
Yeah.
And what the thing that wit and metaphor have in common, I think, is that they both involve making surprising, novel combinations or recombinations of things that come from very, very different fields of knowledge or fields of experience. And so then I got to thinking about wit, and I realized that wit was really at the foundation of so much of what I've been interested in and obsessed by in terms of language and literature and the way the human mind works for such a long time. So that's how I came to start writing about wit.
It's so difficult, it seems, to define it. You quote Alexander Pope up right up front in the book, and he has this essay where he writes about seeking wit, and he talks about the dangers of that as he writes, putting wit under the knife, and how it seems tricky to explore it, but he says, you know, not talk it to death, but bring it to life. And it seems like that's the delicate thing that you're up to, is you don't want to ruin, you know, if we talk too much about the joke, you're going to ruin it. So, but you do want to break it down. So it seems like that was the task you had trying to get this book together.
Yeah, I wanted to understand wit, but I also wanted to celebrate it. And the challenge in writing the book was to be able to do that in a way that, you know, like you said, if you explain the joke, you destroy the joke.
Yeah.
So the challenge in writing this was to do it in a way that was hopefully explanatory to some extent, but that, you know, in journalism, we have a saying, show, don't tell.
Yeah.
You know, that's like the cardinal rule for journalists. Don't tell people what they should know, but show them. And that's a much more engaging way to experience a piece of literature, whether it's journalistic or fiction or poetry. And so I tried to write a kind of more conventional book about wit, and I realized it wasn't working for that very reason. I was telling, not showing.
Right.
And that's how I came up with the idea to actually write the different chapters in styles that correspond to different kinds of wit. So there's a chapter about spiritual wit that's written like a sermon, the chapter about wit, how wit might work in the brain, and neuroscience of wit is written like a scientific paper. As you say, there's a section of the book that's written in emulation of Alexander Pope in Heroic Couplets, and that for me was a kind of key to unlocking unlocking the ability to kind of hopefully make the book not just about wit, but make it witty itself, so that the experience of reading the book would be an experience of wit, not just an experience of hearing someone say stuff about wit.
Yeah, right.
It's a big difference.
Yeah, yeah. Pope gets it right. At least it resonated with me. And there's an epigraph that you include of his where he says, "True wit is what is often thought, but never so well expressed," basically. And it seemed like that is, I guess what he's saying is it's an observation about something that's there, that already exists in nature, but expressing it in a way that is surprising or new?
Yeah. And I the reason I chose that as the epigraph for the book is because I think it's such an important insight about wit.
Yeah.
I think we tend to think of witty people like Oscar Wilde or Mark Twain or Dorothy Parker or, you know, Lucille Ball as kind of exceptional individuals. And they are exceptional, of course. But wit is much, and that's the key to the phrase, what oft was thought.
Yeah.
Wit is something that everybody has. Everybody is witty. And wit is not such a kind of rare intellectual quality that only certain people have or special people have or only comedians or geniuses have. I think wit is something that we all have and we all use every day, and we might not even be aware of it. And I think that comes out in the expressions in that we have for wit. You know, we're living by our wits. We're at our wits' end. You're quick-witted, or you're dim-witted, or you're a nitwit, or you outwit someone. And so none of those words really have anything to do with being funny, but they all have everything to do with a kind of instinctive, quick, improvisational intelligence that helps you get by, that helps you solve problems. That helps you get out of, you know, tricky situations. And, you know, when we say, I'm living by my wits or I'm at my wits' end, it's a universal human experience. I think we've all been there. And I think that's what Pope gets at in that quote. It's what oft was thought. It's a kind of shared experience that we all have, but ne'er so well expressed.
Yeah.
And what makes something witty is the way that it's formulated or the way that it's presented.
So you don't think that wit is a gift bestowed on just certain people. You think we all, in some way, possess some kind of wit.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think there's different kinds of wit, and everybody is witty in different ways.
Yeah.
I think we generally tend to think of wit as verbal. You know, Groucho Marx was incredibly witty. but wit is not only verbal. It can be visual. You know, there's artists who are visually witty. It can be physical. Silent comedians and clowns can be witty. But also inventors and scientists are witty. And people who are very deft at handling complex or tricky social situations. You know, someone who can make you feel at ease in a situation in which you feel awkward or uncomfortable by just saying or doing something or making a gesture. I think that all involves wit because it's, like I said earlier, it involves noticing things and combining things from very different fields of experience, information, endeavor, and synthesizing them into something original and fresh and new. But the material, the raw material that they're working with is, like Pope said, it's oft was thought. It's based on common experience. And it's the formulation that makes something witty. And I think everyone is witty and can be witty. It's just, I think the difference is that not everybody is necessarily verbally witty.
Yeah.
Maybe someone is just a really good inventor and can do things with their hands and can combine found materials and make something really useful and interesting. So yeah, I think wit is a kind of basic aspect of human intelligence and human creativity of which we all partake.
You tell this story later in the book about this dispute between a baker and a poor old woman, which gets us to this idea of practical wisdom. Say a little bit about this, because I really liked thinking of wit in terms that are purely practical.
Yeah, and I think I think that's an excellent point that wit is a kind of intelligence, but it's not a theoretical or conceptual kind of intelligence.
Yeah.
Like you're not devising new theories about how the universe works or something like that. It's very practical, and it involves solving very, very challenging problems. And the story that you referred to is a folk tale about an old woman who was very poor, and she used to stand outside the bakery every morning just to smell the delicious smell of the freshly baked bread. And she didn't have enough money to actually buy any bread, but she just really enjoyed standing outside just to kind of take in the aroma of the delicious bread that was just baked. And the baker, eventually, this began to irritate him. And so one day he stepped outside and he confronted the woman and he said, "Look, if you're going to stand there every day and smell my bread, you're going to have to pay me." And the old woman said, "But I don't have any money. I can't pay you." And, you know, all the villagers kind of gathered around and some took the baker's side and some took the old woman's side. And there was a big dispute. And finally, they decided to call in King Solomon.
Yeah.
And so everybody went over to see King Solomon, and the people, the two protagonists made their case. And King Solomon turned to the old woman and said, "You must pay the baker for the smell of his bread. How much money do you have?" And the old woman looked kind of forlorn and reached into her purse and kind of just jangled the two or three pennies that she had in there. And then King Solomon turned to the baker and said, "Baker, you have been paid."
Right.
And the baker said, "What? She didn't give me any money." And King Solomon said, "Didn't you hear the sound of her coins? That's payment for the smell of your bread."
Yeah.
And that's what I mean, like, about practical wisdom and a kind of wit. The wit in King Solomon's decision, it's not like about language. You know, it's not an especially clever saying that he came up with, but it's about reconciling two very, very different and opposing points of view and finding an angle and a solution and an outcome that is surprising, unexpected, novel, but ultimately just and right and extremely clever.
Yeah.
So I think that gets to the essence of wit as a kind of practical intelligence. It's about solving really, really hard, intractable problems in a way that can reconcile diametrically opposed points of view.
I want to talk about puns for a bit.
Yay!
You love puns, I know. So let's talk about the anatomy of a pun first. First of all, why is a pun so important, do you think, for revealing wit, because you focus a good bit on puns. You say it's the highest display of wit.
That's right. I think the received opinion about puns is that they are the lowest form of wit. And, you know, I've never really agreed with that. And I don't really understand why people think that way. Because what I admire about puns, which are just basically two different words, two different meanings, but they sound the same and you bring them together. And that kind of creates a surprise and a kind of fresh jolt of insight or humor or groaning even.
It's a lot of groaning.
But even the intensity of the groan is kind of evidence of how good the pun is, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So some of the worst puns are actually some of the best puns. So, for example, if you've seen one's shopping center, you've seen them all. That's, you know, a pretty decent pun. But what I think, the reason that I argue in the book that they are really the highest form of wit is because they get at the essence of what we've just been talking about. The ability of the human mind to instinctively and immediately make these really surprising, cool, novel combinations.
Yeah.
And so whoever came up with that pun, you know, realized the sound, the similarity in sound between you, the expression, you've seen them all, and the fact or the experience of seeing an actual mall, that is a shopping center. And that person brought those two things together and made that pun. And it makes you laugh and it makes you groan. And so what I think is so remarkable about puns, though, is that, and this is what I, again, why I think they're so important from the point of view of wit, is that the person who makes a pun and the person who gets a pun or understands a pun are performing exactly the same intellectual creative work.
Yeah.
They're making exactly the same connections. It's just that the person who makes the pun is kind of making the connection in one direction, and the person who gets it is making the connection in the reverse direction. But the journey and the destination are exactly the same. Mm. And that's what, for me, is like the ultimate evidence of how pervasive wit is in the human mind. And how basic a function it is of creativity, because no one has to explain a pun to anyone else. We immediately get it. Even if we hate the pun and we think it's terrible, we immediately get it. And that's wit. That's the mind's instantaneous ability to make those connections. And I think that's a key aspect of wit. It's not about making jokes, although wit can be really, really funny. It's about making connections. And that's what puns demonstrate so powerfully.
Well, you say that in the book that puns aren't just about being funny. There's much about philosophy, and they play with ideas. So there's the expression, as you put it, of this hidden connection between ideas and things.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you more, like, one of the first examples you offer in the book is of a pun anyway, is quite an old one from St. Jerome, who had been given the assignment of translating the old Latin Bible. The Pope gave him this assignment into something more accessible or simpler, at least if I understand this right. So I'm wondering, is a pun designed then to bring something, you know, lofty down to earth, you know, take it down a peg, strip it of its severity and make it more accessible in some way?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also to in part, to make things more accessible by relating them to things that we already know about.
Yeah.
So the pun that you're referring to when St. Jerome translated the old Latin Bible into a kind of newer, simplified version of Latin, he chose the word malum, which means evil in Latin, but it also means apple. It has two meanings. And in the original text of the Bible, in the Garden of Eden, it's not an apple tree. The original description is not an apple tree from which Eve takes the fruit. It's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It's nowhere described in the original text, whether it was an apple, a pear, a lemon. The specific fruit is never, ever mentioned. And it's only because St. Jerome made a pun on malum evil and malum apple that we now come to associate original sin, as it's understood in the Christian faith, as, you know, symbolized by an apple. And that is has huge, obviously, spiritual, religious, philosophical significance. But by kind of concentrating that abstract philosophical meaning in a pun, makes it relatable to something that people can actually experience. And you see puns throughout literature, and they're not always or not even mostly used as jokes. And one of the greatest examples, one of the most inveterate punsters of them all, is William Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. And the average number of puns in a Shakespeare play is 78. Wow. And some plays have, you know, close to 200 plus puns. And if you take like King Lear, for example, the fool in that play, the character of the fool, is always punning. And he makes four different puns on a single comparison of a crown with a kind of hard, basically a hard-boiled egg. And he's making a pun about cutting the egg in half to kind of symbolize what King Lear does with his kingdom by giving it to two of his three daughters. And the fool makes four different puns on that one word, and each one highlights a different aspect of why the fool thinks King Lear himself is a fool, because he made such a terrible mistake in the way he decided to reward his evil daughters and neglect his good daughter. That's the kind of central motif around which that play revolves. So Shakespeare, he makes lots of puns that are both funny and kind of sexually suggestive, but he also uses puns to convey literary meaning, philosophical meaning, and really important symbols, around which the play is constructed.
Yeah, it's when you mention the fool, it brings to mind the section in the book where you write about selected tricksters. How the trickster character in folklore and mythology are pretty much found in every society. Mary Poppins is a trickster, you mentioned. Brer Rabbit, of course. Pippi Longstocking, the coyote in Native American cultures, is a trickster. What is the essential characteristic there? Wit, for sure. But what's the thing behind it? Saying the honest thing? The thing that we've all thought and don't dare say in some ways?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's an essential role of the trickster. And like in folklore across all cultures and countries, you have these trickster figures. And in our own culture, I think the closest thing that we have are clowns.
Yeah.
And what do clowns do? They're constantly violating expectations. Mm-hmm. Clowns are rude. Clowns, you know, will do things that are socially unacceptable or say things that are socially unacceptable. They also do physical tricks like juggling and acrobatics that kind of violate or seem to violate the laws of physics. So I think the essence of the trickster figure is being provocative in a way and subversive in a way by upending our expectations, whether those are social or physical or psychological. And I think that's related to wit in the sense that wit is also about finding the twist or making some clever reversal to what people expect to have happen. And then when you present them with something different and something unexpected, that's the jolt of wit.
Yeah.
And that's the surprise and the delight that we feel when we watch clowns, because they do the things that we fear to do or that we ourselves are unable to do. In that sense, that kind of wit is liberating because we see those norms kind of broken.
Mm.
And then that kind of gives us a sense of liberation for ourselves to kind of think, wow. And I think that's what's so charming about clowns, is because they push the boundaries and we see and accept that, hey, you know, those boundaries can be pushed. And by witnessing something like that, you know, like the Harlem Globetrotters, for example, are great, great tricksters. And they do all those fantastic jokes. And I remember from when I was a kid seeing them, they have these buckets of water by the side of the court and they're splashing each other. And one of the guys grabs a bucket of water and he's about to throw it on someone. And the other player ducks out of the way so that whatever water gets thrown from the bucket is going to end up on the audience. And of course, in the bucket is not water, but confetti.
Yeah.
And that's like a classic visual, witty visual gag. But it's also classic trickster of upending expectations and providing that kind of liberating laughter that results.
Well, upending expectations gets us to jokes, too. And I wanted to talk about that, because you say when you look at their structure, you say about jokes, that pretty much they're all the same. There's the material, there's the setup, there's the punchline. And a joke is establishing this pattern. It's like the bucket of water which turns into confetti. The Harlem Globetrotters are setting you up with this expectation. And then in the punchline, like a joke, they deliver the surprise. It's the same kind of thing. And I guess it's because we're pattern-seeking creatures, and that when you throw us off the pattern, that's the thing that makes us surprised. And that's the thing, I guess, that makes us laugh, right? That's what's delightful about it.
Yeah, it is. And I think you're right. I think the human brain is kind of a pattern-making or a pattern-finding machine. And that's essential from an evolutionary perspective because, you know, to survive, we need to identify and master patterns, you know. So how the agricultural cycle or, you know, the movement of the seasons or the rainy and the dry seasons, from an evolutionary point of view, those patterns are really, really important. But the mind is always seeking patterns. And I think what jokes do, just like a trickster does, is they identify a pattern and kind of lure you into that pattern, and that's the setup for the joke.
Yeah.
And then the punchline either disrupts the pattern or reverses the pattern or completely obliterates the pattern. And that's like, that's when the experience of wit takes place. And I think that's always a kind of the feeling of that when you hear a joke and you get the punchline. It's a feeling of opening up, you know? It's a feeling of release.
Yeah.
And the laughter is it's kind of an expansive thing. And, you know, there's studies that show that there are physical and psychological benefits to laughing. And I think the benefits are that it does have this opening up, both physically, like you're expelling breath and when you laugh and things like that. But something very, very similar happens in your mind, that those patterns that have been established in your brain, they get suddenly opened up. And that, you know, opens up the possibility of new experiences and different perspectives and different insights. And I think that's the tonic of wit and the tonic of humor and the tonic of laughter.
James Geary, his new book is called Wit's End: What Wit Is, How It Works, and Why We Need It. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Do you work for the University of Utah? Are you a public radio nerd? Then donate to KUER through payroll deduction. Decide how much of your paycheck you'd like to put toward programming like Morning Edition, 1A, and Radio West, and the university will send your generous gift to KUER. Your contribution supports factual journalism, Utah stories, and even short films. Get started with payroll deduction by looking under the support tab at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about wit. The journalist James Geary has been writing about wit, and he says it's not just about being funny, but it's a fundamental operating system of human creativity. His book is called Wit's End. In the late 18th century, you write about this friend of the German poet and playwright Friedrich Schiller is complaining to him that he had this block, this creative block. He couldn't get past it. And so Schiller makes this, as you tell it, this diagnosis, which you say in the book has some insights about what we now know of how wit works in the brain. And so I wanted to talk about how it works in the brain, because Schiller says it's basically, look, this is what he's telling his friend. It's bad for creativity if you, as he put it, if you inspect too closely the ideas that are pouring in. So explain what he means and how that mirrors what we know about how wit works in our brains.
Yeah, Schiller is talking about, the way that he put it was the watchers at the gates.
Yeah.
And his friend was complaining that he was just blocked creatively. He couldn't write. He couldn't be creative anymore. And Schiller was basically saying, you're being too critical. You have to, essentially, Schiller, long before Freud, was talking about free association, you know, when you let your mind roam and, and the ideas just come. And, you know, what we also understand today is what's called brainstorming. And what's key during free association and brainstorming is not to judge the ideas that you have, to kind of defer that critical judgmental period and just let the ideas circulate, you know, let the ideas percolate and free associate. So just let your stream of consciousness flow. Try not to interfere with it. And then once you have a critical mass of ideas, that's the time to come in and then choose the best one or be selective or start to organize things. And to the extent that wit has been studied in the brain, and it's very hard to study wit directly, but there are, you know, certain studies that have implications for what I think or how I think wit could be working in the brain. There seems to be an analogy in what Schiller was talking about actually in the human brain. And there are two different networks typically involved in cognition. One is called the default network, which is basically free association or mind wandering, kind of the feeling or the mental state you have when you're, you know, on a train journey or something like that. You're looking out the window, you're just thinking about things. Sometimes you're planning for the future, sometimes you're remembering the past. You're aware of your environment, but not aware of anything in particular about it. So it's kind of an open, receptive mental state. And then there's the executive network, which is that kicks in when we're focused on a single task, like I have to change my tire because I have a flat tire, or I'm trying to figure out this algebra problem, or I have this really challenging management situation at work that I really need to focus on. So the executive network kicks in when you're then very focused on a single task, and the default network is sort of in the background the whole time, taking in information from everything, you know, all over.
So wit comes from the default network.
Well, it comes from the interaction of both. And I think what Schiller was saying was if you don't have the default network active, then you're going to be stuck in the executive network and you can't be creative. So what he was saying, Schiller, is like, you know, tell the executive network to be quiet for a little while and let the default network do its work and then come back with the executive network. And I think that's true. And you know, I'm sure we've lots of people have that experience. You're working on a really hard problem and you're not getting anywhere. And I certainly had this experience writing the book. What do? You go out for a walk. You do something different. You get up and, you know, stroll around or look at something else. And then suddenly, in a moment when you're not thinking about the problem, the solution occurs. And I think that's the balance and the interaction between the default and executive networks. And the wit happens when they're working together rather than against each other.
I'm not sure I knew what to make of this section in the book where you write about this study done on stand-up comedians. They did the study where they were trying, if I get this right, they were trying to see if the process going on in the brains of people who are funny, these stand-up comics, was similar to those who had bipolar disorder.
So that what that study, that's what that study was investigating. And the relationship with wit is people with manic depression, at least in the manic phase, they experience what's called flight of ideas. And that's basically like an unrestrained default network or a default network, you know, run amok. Where, you know, the ideas come really, really quickly and you don't linger on any one, and they just keep going over and over and over, and they can lead into some really amazing, brilliant, surprising directions. And you know, someone who was actually a performer who was like that was Robin Williams. And if you listen to some of his monologues, they're absolutely amazing in the number of connections that he's able to make, and how sometimes strangely remote they seem, but strangely apt at the same time. And when he was in, you know, kind of that flight of ideas
flow state.
It's like a flow state. That's a good way to think of it. That's a, like an amazing demonstration of wit. So what that study was trying to determine was whether you know, that state of mind in a sort of someone with manic depression corresponded to what comics are doing as part of their day job, mm-hmm. or night job in the case of comics. But that's what I was saying earlier. That's one of the few studies to try and specifically look at a certain aspect of wit. And there are kind of aspects of manic depression, the manic phase of it, that do correspond with what we would understand to be comic wit.
Yeah. It made me think about this idea you hear from time to time, that the best stand-up comedy comes from damaged people or dark circumstances. And like the entire, like I was watching Ellen DeGeneres' latest, I think it's on Netflix or special, and the whole conceit for that is whether a rich and successful comedian can still be funny, because really in many ways they're no longer that relatable and they're no longer all that damaged because they've made it. What do you think about that? This idea that once you sort of heal yourself or lose your weight and become successful, you're not that funny anymore.
I'm very skeptical of that, that theory. And I think it not only is applied to like comedians and people like that, but painters or writers, and you have to suffer to be an artist, and you have to suffer to be a poet. And I don't really agree with that. I think what's important about being an artist is experiencing things deeply. And for example, you know, a novelist doesn't actually personally experience all the things that he or she writes about. Yeah. But a great novelist is empathetic enough to be able to write about those things convincingly. They can do that because they live imaginatively through those experiences and are able to express them. And so I think personal experience is important. And the more experience you have and the more different kinds of experience you have, the richer an artist you will be. Richer, I mean that metaphorically, sure. Not financially. But I don't really accept that suffering is like the key thing or the only thing. To bring it back to wit or comedians, I think, again, what wit has to do with is making connections. Yeah. And I think a truly witty person, a truly creatively witty person, is able to connect her own experience with someone else's experience. And what makes a comic relatable is, regardless of their own experience, that they are able to tap into this kind of universal experience that, you know, what is oft thought, as Alexander Pope put it, and reflect back to audiences their own experience.
Yeah.
That so that, you know, what do you love about a comedian is because you think, you listen to her and you think, wow, she's really knows something about life or my life, or I can really relate to that. Why do you love a film or a novel or a poem or a piece of music? It's because you feel yourself in it and you recognize yourself in it. And I think that has way more to do with the artist's ability to make connections with universal human experience than with the artist's personal experience of any one kind of suffering. So,
you're
really
not buying
subscribe
it.
To that.
I think you're right. And because to me, it seems like a comedian, just because they become successful, doesn't mean they stop being, stop having this capacity for observation. And that gets to this massive theme in your book, I think, this idea of how wit is about paying attention.
Yeah.
And there's this section where you write about habits. Perception is a habit, you say, and habit is the enemy of wit. Let's talk about that, because this gets us to this idea of observation and paying attention and how that's such a critical part of wit. But start with this idea of habit. There's this Russian writer you refer to, and he's a critic too, Viktor Shklovsky.
Yeah.
Did I get that name right?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I can't pronounce
Let's
it myself.
Let's go with it. And he said this. He said, habituation devours objects. And that if all the complex lives, I'm quoting him now, as you do in the book, if all the complex lives of many people go on unconsciously, then such lives are as if they never have been. So talk a little bit about this idea of wit being about being just conscious of your place and and paying attention.
Yeah, and that's such a haunting quote. Kind of, it's a little bit chilling to read that. But I think it has to do, habit has to do with what we were talking about earlier and patterns. Yeah. I think it's crucial, and we survive by being able to recognize patterns. But once we recognize a pattern and it becomes habitual, you stop being alive to it. You stop being sensitive to it. And I think that's what Viktor Shklovsky, which I think is how I pronounce it anyway, was getting at. And that what art does is kind of makes the world fresh again, makes the world new again by breaking that habitual pattern of perception. So the example that I use in the book and that I experience every day is like your morning commute to work. You take the same route, whether you're driving or you take the bus, you take the subway or you walk, but typically you take the same route every day. And you gradually, the more you do that, the less you see. It's the weird kind of paradox of familiarity. The more you see a thing, the less you actually see that thing. You start to perceive it habitually, and then you stop seeing it altogether. So one thing that I used to do at a particularly challenging time in my professional life is my morning walk. I would deliberately take different routes to work. So I would see different things, and that would keep my mind kind of fresh and alert. So I think the danger that habit poses to wit is that you stop paying attention. And wit really demands of us that we pay attention to our surroundings, and that we pay attention in the way that the default network pays attention, that we pay attention to everything, you know. So like having kind of like a 360 degree awareness of our physical, not just our physical environment, but our kind of emotional environment, our psychological environment, which involves other people and their states of mind as well. And I think how that kind of translates into witty visual art is that if you think of, you know, your favorite painter, your favorite visual artist, in some way they are making the world new for you. Yeah. They are showing you something from an angle at which you've never seen it before. And that makes everything seem different. And, you know, I'm sure we've all had the experience of going to a art exhibition or seeing a movie, and you come out of there and it's like, you know, it's like you look around and things just seem different. The lights seem brighter. The colors seem more intense. It's like that feeling after a thunderstorm or something where the actual physical environment just feels really vivid and alive. And I think that's what visual wit can do by breaking perceptual habits. And you can see it in, you know, so-called high art. I don't really give much credence to those high-low designations, but you can see it in things like painting. You know, someone like Van Gogh, who has such a unique and powerful vision, it makes you see a sunflower in a totally different way. But also in the Harlem Globetrotters, where you see a bucket of water suddenly is something different, something other. And I think that's what wit can do by breaking perceptual habits, just makes the world fresh again.
There's a section in the book about habits and how habit is the enemy of wit. It's an idea put forward by the Russian writer and critic Viktor Shklovsky. Geary says Shklovsky came up with this different way of seeing the world. He called it defamiliarization, making the commonplace in our lives uncommon again. Shklovsky said that the idea of art was to defamiliarize things. And you tell this great story in the book that right around the time that he's writing about this, the Soviet Union is trying to strip things of their double meaning. Mm-hmm. And it's just so interesting. You also write about China, and it just seems like in dictatorships and authoritarian governments, they hate puns, right? And they right. like hate ambiguity. They hate wit, it seems like, and it just doesn't fit right. in their system, I guess.
That's right. And I think that's another reason to love puns, because dictators hate them.
Yeah.
I think in authoritarian regimes, they, and you know, we have unfortunately many examples of this politically today, mm-hmm. they want everything to be one way, the way that they would like it to be interpreted. And certainly in the Soviet Union and in China today, the censors went to extreme lengths to make sure that ambiguity did not reach the people. So in the Soviet Union, they would, physically police, inspect the print newspapers. So this is the 1920s, when people were still reading print newspapers. And there's one example I give in the book where one censor noticed that a picture of a photograph of a hammer that was on one side of one page, if you held it up to the light, it looked like the hammer was hitting the head of a picture of Stalin, which was on the other side of the page. You know how if you hold a paper up to the light, you can see what's on both sides at the same time. And, that's kind of the insane lengths to which censors would go to prevent any kind of ambiguity. And the same thing is happening online in China today, where the Chinese censors will delete social media posts that broach topics that they don't want to have discussed. And so what Chinese internet users do is they make puns and they use ambiguity to get around the censorship. And I think that's the great power of wit, to be subversive in an authoritarian regime. By using misdirection, by using puns, by using double meanings, by exploiting ambiguities in language or in images, you can communicate really powerful and important and necessary political truths in ways that censors either don't get or can't stop. And the way that the Chinese do it is, they make these puns on various words or people's names, which they're not allowed to make social media posts about. But then once the censor realizes, oh, this is a pun, but it means this prescribed word, they just make another pun, and it goes on and on like that. And it's also like we were talking about earlier, no one explains that to Chinese internet users, but everyone understands, aha, the pun has changed because the censors have caught on, and now we're talking about this other pun. But they're still able to get it and to follow it and to build on it. And I think that's the resilience of wit, the ability of the human mind to kind of, with very few resources, to exploit those ambiguities in language or imagery, and to constantly create something new. It's kind of amazing how rich ambiguity can be from the perspective of wit.
It kind of brings us to this sermon you write toward the end of the book on, as you put it, on the purpose of wit. And I wanted to ask you about it. You write about how everywhere we look, there are signs. We're always looking for a sign. And we want reassurance. But you say signs don't always give us direction. They don't always give us clarity. So we have to use our wit, you say, to unravel this tangle of signs. And you point out that wit has given us, as you put it, this homiletic eyes, eyes that see signs and homilies. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about this part from your sermon, this idea of how we can see wit's signature in all things.
Mm-hmm. That sermon, it's the last chapter in the book, and the title of the book is Wit's End, and I'm afraid it's a pun.
Yeah, of course. Good one.
The end of wit, but also, as you said a minute ago, what is the purpose of wit? To what end do we have wit? And I think, as we've been discussing, wit gives us the ability to spot similarities, to spot patterns, to spot the connections between things. And I think what I'm trying to get at in that sermon is it's basically a sermon about living by your wits. Yeah. And I think when, at least that's been my experience, when you're going through a difficult emotional or psychological time or some kind of personal crisis, we all look for signs, and this is what the scriptures of religions from all over the world are about. They're the signs of grace, or the signs of salvation, or the signs of redemption, depending on your faith. But even if you're not a person of faith, you look for signs, and to just kind of find your place in the world and determine if you're on the right track. You know, literally a signpost. That's what keeps you on the right path when you're traveling in an unknown place. But also psychologically and emotionally, we look for those signs too, to just kind of reassure ourselves emotionally or internally that we're on the right path. And I think that's the essence of what living by your wits is all about. It's, again, comes down to paying attention to what's around you, and then you make a decision, and then look for the signs that decision is the correct one. And I remember one time I used to live in San Francisco and was contemplating a big change in my life, and had actually embarked on it. But, you know, I'm sure we've all had this experience too. You take the first couple steps in a new direction and then suddenly think, wait a minute.
Right. What
is
have
this
I done?
The right thing?
Yeah.
And I was in the Zen garden of the Golden Gate Park, and there was just a sign there, a literal sign on the grass that said, "Keep on the path." And so that's, for me, was an example of my mind making a witty connection. That was a physical sign that was literally telling people, please don't step on the grass. But for me, it came at a time when I was in a place where I was looking for an emotional, psychological sign. And my mind made the connection between stay on the path in this Zen garden in the Golden Gate Park, but also stay on this path that you've chosen that is really scary and is going to take you into an unknown place, but be confident because that's the path you should stay on. And I think that's what the sermon is trying to get at, to use our homiletic eyes to be able to see those kind of signs in ourselves, in our loved ones, and the people around us, and in our environment, the signs that connect what's going on inside our hearts and inside our minds with what's going on outside in our lives.
The book is Wit's End: What Wit Is, How It Works, and Why We Need It. James Geary, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you so much, Doug. I really appreciate it.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.